So much is different because of the coronavirus. So many things not happening. Today came word that the Olympics will be put off until next year. All major sports are on pause until there's progress in containing the virus, so we can't watch baseball games, not current ones anyway. But we can certainly talk about baseball, and today we have the authors of two books written for younger readers about the game. Derek Barnes wrote, Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing But True Stories. Derek, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. Is Derek there? I don't see Derek. Okay, let's move on to Anika Orok, who is the author of The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Anika, are you with us?
I am. Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Anika is a writer, designer, illustrator, cartoonist, and more. She's worked with several organizations to promote the advancement of girls and women in baseball. So good to have you here, Anika.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
So women really have advanced in baseball. Who wrote the foreword in your book?
That would be Jean Afterman, who is the second of three women to ever hold her position in the executive offices of Major League Baseball.
Wow, and she brings up a great point in the book in a time reference in the fact that the women's baseball, the Women's Professional Baseball League, basically just came 20 years after women got the right to vote.
Yeah, isn't that incredible?
It truly
it's
is.
Kind of amazing to think of the exponential, momentum after that.
Let's back up just a little bit before we get into the guts of your book and just talk about disappointment first. I mean, how weird is it to live in this world in spring without baseball?
Oh, you know, I want to complain and be so sad about it, but, you know, clearly there are more important things, but it feels to me like Christmas being canceled for a kid. I look forward to it all year, and I work to the sound of baseball on the radio, and I just, yeah, it's difficult, but it just shows, you know, where we're at, and it's important that we keep our spirits up however we can, I guess.
Now, Derek Barnes, you're with us now, right?
Yes, I'm here. How you guys doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Now, you've got four boys. Are they all going stir-crazy, not playing sports on teams?
Man, you know, when you chime me in, I have my phone on mute because I had to give out some marching orders, man. You know, I haven't... It's crazy. Having four boys at home, you know, I am used to the chaos because, I mean, we've played every single sport. If you name it, we have probably done it. My eldest boy is home. He's a freshman in college at North Carolina A&T. So he's here now. And, man, you know, we have 7-on-7 football. We have track and field right now that's obviously being canceled. So it's real tough keeping these guys active, but we're making it happen, though.
All right, that's good. And then let me give you the full setup that I didn't give when you weren't here. You wrote the chapter book series, Ruby and the Booker Boys, the picture book, The King of Kindergarten, and the picture book, Crown, An Ode to the Fresh Cut. So you follow this up with Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing But True Stories. How deep does baseball go in your family, Derek?
Well, we live in Charlotte, North Carolina now, but I am from Kansas City, Missouri, and some of my earliest and fondest memories are of just learning about Satchel Paige and the Kansas City Monarchs. Obviously, in 1985, the Royals win the first World Series with George Brett, mm-hmm. Willie Wilson, and so you know I've been a huge baseball fan, you know, for a long time. But a lot of it's been centered around just you know local legends. 44 now, and I still can remember in 85 when we played that I-70 series against the Cardinals. It was just a lasting memory for me, you know.
Yeah, that was 3 years after I graduated from the University of Missouri, which is right smack in between the two cities, so sorry I wasn't there at the time.
Yep, Columbia, man.
Mm-hmm, truly. So yep. Now, Anika, you are the illustrator for your own book, is that right?
I am, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, Derek, give your illustrator a plug.
My illustrator's name is John Bajay, and he actually illustrates. He does animation. I guess he's most famous for doing Tom and Jerry, like mm-hmm. the remake for the Tom and Jerry series. So, shout out to John.
Okay, now there are 42 stories in the book, but I imagine you probably started with about 42,000 in your head.
You know it. I'm thinking about doing a part two. Because there's just not enough Yeah, there's not enough stories to be told.
Yeah, no doubt about that. So you had to pick these. How'd you categorize the book, Derek?
I broke it down in four sections. This is actually book one in a series. The other two are going to be basketball and football, but I just really want to focus on the unheralded pillars in the sport, folks that you just can't find if you go to, you know, Wikipedia or Google. And I broke it down in four parts. The first chapter is pivotal players, and the second part is sensational stories. The third chapter is radical records, because we know baseball is all about records, uh-huh, stats, and numbers. And the fourth chapter, which is very important to me, colossal comebacks. You know, teams that may have struggled. And it's not just games. You know, I also highlight players that, you know, maybe have had illnesses or, you know, injuries and found a way to make it back and become a, you know, pivotal player again.
Yeah, like John Hiller is a good example of that. I that story was lost at me as it was happening, but a heart attack that looked like it was going to end his career, and he came back and he pitched okay, and then he just pitched a lot better over time.
Yep, and man, it's so many stories. You know, you were right. I ended up writing like maybe 20 to 25 stories for each chapter, and then we just kind of narrowed it down to like 8 to 10 for each one.
Wow, that's a lot of
stories to be told. Yeah.
Anika, how much of a debt do you figure you owe to the movie A League of Their Own for giving a at least a stepping stone toward this book?
Well, I would say quite a large debt, in the fact that I think for me, like for a lot of people, that was sort of the only route I had, as far as, you know, the only story I knew of women in baseball. When I sort of dug in and wanted to find stories about women in baseball, that was kind of the go-to starting point. And I learned so much more about so many other women in so many other chapters of history in baseball. But I just had so much fun with that one that I just kept going. But had it not been for the movie, I think most of the world would never have known that this league existed. Even if it was sort of a Hollywood, you know, a fictionalized version, they still got the spirit of the league right, and they got a lot of important things right. And I think it wouldn't have been known about otherwise.
It was a lot of fun to read through your book and realize that the movie didn't make a lot of stuff up. I mean, it certainly glamorized a few things beyond where they might have been in real life, but there really were some really good players and some really good games in there. Now, I want to talk about the origins, though, of what became the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which had several names along the way. Some big names in Major League Baseball kindled this, didn't they?
Sure. Well, you've got P.K. Wrigley, who started it or came up with the idea, and the only person he could really get on board with him as far as, you know, organizing anything was Branch Rickey, who, you know, did a lot to bring a lot of unknowns and marginalized people into the world of Major League Baseball. So, but Wrigley bankrolled the whole thing himself, and then, yeah, you've got a lot of major league coaches and former major league Hall of Famers that came on to coach the All-Americans. And, so it's kind of a lot of big names in baseball that really jumped on board.
There was a concern in Major League Baseball during the war, because this is when this happened, that was there a concern that they might not be able to field major league teams?
Yeah, I mean, you know, every able-bodied man had to be either off fighting somewhere or in, you know, there were a lot of war-related production jobs that needed to be filled. But really, for anyone playing baseball, it was, you know, if you could go and fight, that was the priority. So even though, you know, it was sort of questionable as to whether or not the business of baseball and games would continue on, even with it moving forward, as FDR sort of suggested it should, there weren't many men to fill the rosters. So I think that's where you get a lot of really interesting stories in baseball that, you know, like in that are filling the pages of Derek's book. But you've got some really interesting characters that entered into Major League Baseball at that time, apart from these women. But this was definitely the kind of bigger, more successful aspect of that.
Yeah, Pete Gray immediately comes to mind, the one-eyed outfielder for the St. Louis Browns. But you actually bring a different person into focus here, Derek, for the first person with a disability to play Major League Baseball. Tell us about Mordecai Brown.
Mordecai Brown was, first of all, he only had on his pitching hand, he had an accident when he was a child. He was running in his yard and fell and got it caught in one of the farming machines, and his hand got mangled. So he only had three functional fingers on what ended up being his pitching hand, but he ended up still learning how to play baseball. He mastered a grip in order to hold the ball, which ended up, you know, working to his advantage, because even guys that had five fingers could not grip the ball in this way, which gave it a different rotation. He started off, you know, kind of stunning everyone, but after a while, you know, I think the batters and the managers got hip to his rotation and kind of found out that he was very limited in what he could do. But you're talking about a guy that made, you know, lemonade out of lemons, you know what I mean, and becoming a major league pitcher.
Yeah, I didn't even think about the fact that his situation. Yeah, I didn't think about the fact that his ball movement would have been notable because of the grip he was able to hold the ball with.
Yeah, outstanding, man.
Let's talk about the first person in the book, because we're Anika mentioned marginalized people, and these were the women who ended up in the baseball league. But Rube Foster is the first person you talk about in your book, an excellent pitcher, but he wanted to do more than just be a player, so he was notable for many things.
Yeah, I was. You know, everyone's been kind of vegging out watching, you know, Netflix, and there's a documentary up now on Madam C.J. Walker, and she, you know, kind of remind me of, you know, Rube, and how Rube didn't just want to be on one of these traveling Negro League teams. No, I mean, this was before there was actually a league, but, you know, because they couldn't actually play in the leagues, these teams full of black and Latino players had to travel around the country. And he was so talented, you know, during the off season, he would go up against major league teams, you know, during their off seasons. And he would do an excellent job against, you know, major league hitters. He was able to organize in my hometown at a YMCA in Kansas City, a whole league of black baseball team owners, and formed the, you know, which came to be the first version of the, you know, the Negro Leagues, which is a term that everyone clumps together. There wasn't actually a long-running Negro League. There were multiple forms of Negro League baseball teams all across the country, but Rube was actually the first one to actually get this, you know, going in motion, that we didn't need to be a part of Major League Baseball or part of the larger league, that we could actually set up leagues on our own. And just a huge debt of gratitude is owed to this guy, who was just a great organizer.
Yeah, Rube Foster. It's kind of sad to think, though, that it was 17 years after his death that Jackie Robinson finally got to play in the major league. So certainly a huge talent pool of men who could play baseball. But so Anika, what was the situation, though, with women? I mean, how many young women played softball or baseball in any form by the time the league started in 1943?
Well, in an organized fashion, not many. There were some organized softball leagues, you know, recreational and local leagues around that many of the players did play in, but actually the majority of the players that I spoke with and whose interviews I accessed, I was surprised to learn that none of them had ever played any sort of organized ball other than, you know, playing on sand lots or in back alleys with just all the boys in the neighborhood. And many of them, when they were scouted for the league or went to tryouts, were very surprised to see other women do it. You know, they kind of all grew up with this notion that they were the only one, because they were the only one in their neighborhood or on their street or in their town, maybe. And so I love that thought. I love that idea of walking into a place and suddenly seeing all these other young girls and women that could play ball. And, you know, a lot of them thought they would be the best one there because they thought, well, I'm the only girl that's been playing with these boys. I'm probably going to be the best one here. And walking in and realizing, oh, wow, I'm not. And all these women could really play. And so I think it's really great that they got the opportunity to do so in an organized professional capacity.
We have not one but two baseball books here on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about. Anika Orok's book, which she also illustrated, is called The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, which lasted in several forms from 1943 to 1954. Derek Barnes is the author of Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing but True Stories. It's the first of a series that'll move on to basketball and football next. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Let's talk baseball because nobody's playing it right now. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Anika, tell us about some of the reactions to the new league in 1943. It seems like not all people were quite taken with the idea.
Yeah, well, you know, as you can imagine, it was not really a time in our country's history where things like that were very common or acceptable. But, you know, roles were shifting for women at that time, and it was sort of an all-hands-on-deck kind of like now. Everybody had to take part in some way, shape, or form. And I think some bets were off, but really definitely knew that if it was going to succeed, it had to be highly feminine to sort of pass the social test. And so that brought on a lot of skepticism. I think there was it was treated very much as a novelty in the beginning, almost like kind of a publicity thing, or, you know, and one of the players in the book, Pepper Pear, even says, you know, I think a lot of people came for the legs and stayed for the baseball because, and that was absolutely true. If you, you know, looking through the newspaper articles that I was researching, when I started really digging in, it was very fascinating to see that everything that started right around 1943 was very, you know, pass the powder puff, dearie, and, you know, we're going to have to pass on the potatoes to keep a trim figure. It just very cringeworthy, to say the least, but comical, and, you know, it was not taken seriously. But very shortly after that, you know, even some articles later in 1943 and 1944, it became clear that people who attended these games realized the level of athleticism and competitiveness, and that they were watching real baseball.
Indeed they were, and I love the story in particular of Carolyn Morris, who went by India. She was a pitcher, but a model in the off season, and got into a game with some boys who were playing off in some community she was playing in.
Yeah, yeah, I love that story too. She just kind of spotted some kids playing sandlot ball and said, hey, how about letting me have a hit, you know? And there was also a rule in the league that women, you know, that they were all required to wear skirts and dresses. There were no pants when they weren't playing, which is ironic because they were wearing skirts when they were playing. But yeah, and she it said in the article that I pulled from, it said she pasted one all the way to Wyoming, which I love. But, you know, she just walloped one. And the first thing out of the kid's mouth when they finally said something was, do you have a brother that would play with us? I just love that. And I love that she did have a brother. But, you know, it's like, wow, you could really hit.
Yeah,
you know, a boy?
Yeah, she was the baseball star, though. So, which brings us back to Derek's book, Who Got Game? Baseball, Amazing but True Stories. You got groundbreakers like, we talked about Rube Foster, Hank Greenberg, the first Jewish-American player, Ozzie Virgil, the first Dominican player. But then you get to a woman yourself. Who was Lizzie Murphy?
Lizzie Murphy is considered probably the first female superstar in baseball. When you think about, this is my first nonfiction project, so I did so much research, and, you know, when you talk about the forming of baseball leagues in this country, they were mostly centered around textile plants, and the owners of these textile plants needed, you know, entertainment for their workers. But the only people that were allowed to play were mostly men, and mostly, you know, white men. Women were not allowed to play. But, you know, going back to Liz Murphy, she was one of the first stars, started back in, like, 1860 in Vassar College. Shout out to Vassar College.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they had the first all-women's team. And, you know, she's also the first player, man or woman, to play in a, in, you know, for both, you know, major league, you know, conferences. She played in many all-star games. She was on, you know, traveling teams. And just an inspiration for, you know, many female athletes today. You know what I mean? You know, so not just baseball players, but, you know, Lizzie Murphy, you know, her her character was actually, I don't know the actress that actually played her, but she was in the League of Her Own.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you know, she was one of the characters in that movie as well. But yeah, she was a real groundbreaker.
And let's bring a call in here, and that would be from Kay in Eureka. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Derek Barnes and Anika Orok, authors of baseball books for younger readers. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I was calling in because I thought you might want to hear a personal story.
Sure.
When I was in seventh grade in 1948, I moved to a little town called Orik.
Mm-hmm.
And the girls in town formed their own a softball team, and we played about a 120-mile radius. Of course, we had our own equipment and no uniforms, and we did our own traveling. And when I went into high school a couple years later, the girls that I had played with sent me in to talk to the superintendent principal and ask if we couldn't play inter-school sports because we were limited to just playing after-school sports. And, you know, no audience or anything, just a, kind of almost like a pickup game.
Uh-huh.
So he patiently listened to me and then explained that, no, that wouldn't be possible because girls were not emotionally equipped to play inter-school sport.
I can hear Anika laughing already.
Yeah. And that we would probably cry. And, of course, I sat back in my chair and said, what? I've never cried in a baseball game in my life. There's no crying in baseball. And then when I heard that from Tom Hanks in the movie, it really cracked me up because it was so true.
Did you finally get that play interscholastic sports out of for girls in order?
No, of course not.
Mm.
I was well out of college before Title IX went in, and it really changed everything for women in schools.
All right. Well, thanks.
Women in sports.
Right. Thank you so much for sharing that story, Kay. I appreciate that. Anika, this rings true for you on a couple levels, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. And I, you know, I think it's so interesting to hear Kay's story about. There's even a story in this book about one of the players going into the superintendent of her college after she had been playing professional baseball as a paid professional athlete. And then in the off season, you know, a lot of these women would go back to factory work or go to school. They had earned enough money to access higher education. And this one player was playing catch and practicing with one of the boys she went to school with, and she was called in to speak with the superintendent, who told her, "We don't do that here, and women don't, you know, we don't play baseball. Girls don't. You're not. This is not for you." Even though she'd already played at least two seasons of professional baseball, so yeah, it's comical and. It's upsetting, and you can get frustrated and angry, but some of the ways that it was handled and some of the excuses, like, for instance, you're not emotionally equipped,
right.
It's all you can do is laugh because it's absurd.
It is indeed, but lots of situations actually in both books of people saying, no, you can't do that because of who you are or what you were born with, and we'll get into that a little further as we continue our conversation with Anika Orok, who wrote The Incredible Women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League, and Derek Barnes, who wrote Who Got Game? Baseball Amazing But True Stories. A fair amount, I would say, of Who Got Game is dedicated to people who really did push to make sure that that baseball was more inclusive over time. And you tell us the stories in the book, Derek, of people long before Jackie Robinson. Several men get credit, but would you tell us the story about Moses Walker and his confrontation with Cap Anson?
Matt, you know, I am big on, you know, genealogy and history. Mm-hmm. And for all of us, really, to learn as much as we can about, you know, not just sports history, but just American history. And a lot of the people that have been lifted up as being heroes really were not nice people. But, you know, I don't know if they were just, you know, men of their time. But, you know, Cap Anson is a MLB Hall of Famer, one of the greatest players of all time. But he was not for segregation, especially in the sport that he loved.
Not for integration,
and,
yeah.
No, not at all. And so, anytime he was faced with a team who had players of color, mostly African-American players, he always threatened to pull his players out because he was also a manager. And he refused to play against black baseball players, you know, which was unfortunate.
And so Moses Fleetwood Walker, I guess, came up against him in July of 1887. Or no, it was 1883 was the earlier game, I guess.
And he refused to play against him. And so the game ended. And, these are the things that I just wanted to point out in this series. You know, those stories are never told. You know, when you bring out the greatness or the athleticism of a lot of these players who in many ways were American heroes, but, you know, there's also a dark side, you know, to a lot of these players, so.
Absolutely. So let's move on to some happier subject matter here, because you got some non-players in here. Frank Job comes in here, which he's not a household name, but if you say Tommy John, suddenly you realize what it was that Frank Job did.
He is the creator of the Tommy John's surgery. Who, this guy's a hero. They call him the Elbow Whisperer because he saved so many careers in baseball. He found out that once the tendons in the elbow get worn out, that you can take tendons from other parts of the body and insert them inside the elbow, because a lot of times that Lance Frank injury was like a career ender.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked for the Oakland A's at the time as a team doctor, and, you know, just as a experimental try, he found out that, you know, you can move these tendons around, and that's one of the most popular surgeries still today. It kind of deterred that in, you know, the young pitchers, because these kids are pitching a lot now. There's really no off season in any of these sports.
Right.
So you can have a kid that's 13, 14 that has the same injury. I really try to pull my kids back. You know, there's no off season with football and track and field. So, you know, we kind of try to pull back, but you know, the Tommy John's surgery is a lifesaver, a game changer for a lot of major league pitchers. And
yeah, really, as a lot of people who would have in previous years had to retire, ended up being able to continue their careers for quite a long time afterward once they got the Tommy John surgery to fix those elbow ligaments. Which brings me back to women's baseball, because now the rules actually changed several times over the years. As you point out, Anika, they were not throwing overhand originally, were they?
No, they weren't. The league actually started as the All-American Girls Softball League because that was socially and otherwise, I think, a safer bet and more understood when Wrigley founded it. But he instilled a few kind of baseball-like rule changes in the very beginning, like, you know, leadoff running and the amount of players on the field, and base pass distances were already a little bit longer. But as soon as they realized how good these women were and how competitive they were and how competitive the games were, they had to really make changes pretty quickly. And by the end of that season, I believe the name of the league had pretty much already been changed to the All-American Girls Baseball League. But yeah, those changes came pretty much every season. They had to increase base pass distance, increase mound to home plate distance, change the pitching style, change the ball size, and everything just got, the field got bigger and the ball got smaller, and the pitching style evolved to overhand, you know, within a couple of years. And I mean, to me, that just says so much more even about the athleticism of these women to show up multiple seasons and just be told once they arrived to spring training, by the way, your pitching style is going to change, the ball got smaller, and go. Pretty impressive.
It is indeed, but I love the comment by one of the players, or at least one of the players that you quote in the book, who said, "Wow, you can really grip this ball."
Yeah, and hit it and throw it. I think a lot of them, you know, because a lot of these women did grow up playing baseball and with baseball, so I think that's it's an interesting thing that we have always sort of perceived softball as being some sort of version of baseball, or you know, it's girls play softball, boys mm-hmm. play baseball. But really, even myself, I didn't realize until I started this book and until I had the opportunity to interview some of the women who contributed to the afterword of the book, just how different they are as sports. They are two completely different sports. And so to ask someone to just, you know, "Oh, you play baseball? Great. You'll do great with softball." It's like a completely different, it's like saying, "Oh, you play tennis? Great. Come play professional field hockey or something." You know, it's just a totally different adjustment. So I think a lot of those women, when it's made that quick evolution to baseball, they're like, "Okay, great. Now I know how to play this."
Right. So here again, your book focuses on the years of the All-American, what became the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Now, Derek's book, being able to take in a little more broadly, goes in the years before that. And there's another woman in your book, Jackie Mitchell, who is another really interesting story, but she actually faced some of the toughest hitters in baseball at one point.
Yeah, you know, she was actually a teenager, and she played for a team called the Tennessee Lookout. But she was such an excellent pitcher, and I think, you know, I think many people think that this was a hoax and just a way to sell tickets, that she actually went up against two of the most dangerous hitters of all time. She went up against Babe Ruth, who started out as one of the most amazing pitchers with the Boston Red Sox, and I know a lot of Yankee fans are cringing at the idea that Babe Ruth was a Red Sox fan. But he also became one of the most amazing hitters, obviously, of all time. But they had an exhibition game. It wasn't even actually a game, but they had Jackie Mitchell, who was a 17-year-old girl, pitching against Babe Ruth and actually struck Babe out. And he's a teenage girl that actually struck Babe out. And then the next guy up to bat was the great Lou Gehrig. And she actually made him whiff. Back-to-back Hall of Fame power hitters. Now, again, a lot of people still think that this was a hoax and it was just a way to sell tickets. But I don't think so, man. You know, I think that there are, I think that, you know, Jackie, you know, she might have been a prodigy. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, which lends itself to, you know, we're talking about a professional women's league, a professional, you know, whether it be softball or a actual baseball league, that, I mean, we have no idea how great of a talent, you know, the talents that we may be passing up on. And, you know, Babe, he refused to talk about the issue, which makes me believe that, you know, this was actually real, that this teenage girl actually put some heat that old Babe Ruth couldn't, you know, get his bat on, man. So shout out to Jackie Mitchell and all the talented young ladies out there that are throwing over 80, 90 miles per hour, you mm-hmm. know.
So now, yeah. Jackie was a teenager around 1930. She would have been about the right age to be able to play in the GPBS. see how hard it gets. AAGPBL. So, but did she? Is there any record that she played in that league, Anika?
Because the league, she would have been. Well, she was 17 at that time, and I believe that her pitching against the. What is called Murderer's Row, as Derek is describing it, was, I believe, in 1929.
Okay.
I don't know if I'm correct. So the league was formed quite a bit later than that. So she would have probably been past the age that she was eligible, or maybe had even gone on to do other things at that point. But I love Derek's point of, you know, the realization of what we may have seen or what we've never known. And I love that that's what his book touches on, because, you know, I love that story of Jackie Mitchell. And actually, there's an animated short film being made called Curves, if anybody is interested in following that. I think it's in production now, but about that whole story. But she maintained until the day she died that she gave it her best. And, you know, there's no one that studied Jackie, really, except after the fact. No one knew her pitches all that well. No one, you know, there's all kinds of research and researchers who've studied Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth. Mm-hmm. But what I love is that the people who are experts on Babe Ruth and Lou Gehrig are kind of sided with they also believe that she may have just actually struck them out based on their character, based on their records, their hitting style, all this other evidence. And the same thing could be said for, say, the Negro Leagues, where there's just these incredible stories, and they didn't really have, there weren't people keeping meticulous records like there were in the major leagues. And I'm just so grateful for people like Derek, or if you've, speaking of Kansas City, if you've ever been to the Negro Leagues Museum, Bob Kendrick could just be the museum himself. He's one of the greatest storytellers I've ever seen or been around in my life. I could just listen to him all day. But thank heavens there are people perpetuating these stories where the numbers and the records lack, because I think that's where we realize the real value of these people and what they did contribute and what they could have contributed. And again, the same goes for the women, African-American women who would have been eligible to play in the All-American Girls League who were not given the opportunity. Thankfully, they, you know, several of them went on to do great things in baseball themselves, but it's a lesson that we can all take from now.
Indeed. We and it's nice when we recognize that they're still among us, some of them. Sharon in Eugene writes that, "I've had the opportunity to get to know Lois Youngen, who lives in Eugene. She's a delightful 86-year-old who's been a regular attendee at Oregon softball games and graciously signed middle schooler autographs." And you know of her, Anika.
I know of her, and she's in the book. There are several quotes from Lois in the book, and when I saw that I would be doing this show, I got excited, hoping that maybe Lois will be listening or I could give a shout-out to Lois, because she's wonderful. She's absolutely wonderful.
Well, Sharon, let us know that Lois is out there. So thanks for that, Sharon. Appreciate that. Let's finish up with your final in-game play, Derek, The Catch, Willie Mays in the 1954 World Series. What made that feat so amazing?
I think what made that play so amazing, if you're a hardcore baseball fan, you know about, you know, Willie Mays, but I think at that time we were not accustomed to seeing, maybe if you followed the Negro Leagues, people were accustomed to seeing that kind of athleticism, but, you know, people had never seen a outfielder make that kind of catch. I mean, here he is facing this gigantic outside wall, and I mean he had the skills of an NFL, you know, wide receiver, uh-huh, to be able to catch this ball over his shoulder, running full speed, knowing full well that he's headed towards this gigantic wall, and to not only catch it but to throw the ball back infield. So I mean he is probably the greatest five-tool player of all time.
Amazing stories from Derek Barnes with Who Got Game? Baseball Amazing But True Stories, and Anika Orok, the incredible women of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League. Thank you both so much.